Man conquered the planet not because of the power of his hands, but because of his capacity to use his brain. We used to hunt mammoths, and we used to predict where the mammoths would run so that we could chase them off the side of cliffs, causing them to have terrible injuries as they fell, where we could stab them to death at the bottom and feed our tribes for weeks. It was our ability to imagine what the mammoth was doing for us to achieve that victory. But it has been a long time since we have been hunters in the steppe of ancient Russia. Now, we find ourselves in super industrial societies, and our experience of work and life is the labor that we have to go through in order for us to achieve success. We have to go and work long, hard hours, saving up our money so we can buy our mortgage, so that we can get our house and find our little place in the sun where we can start our family. And most people's conception of what you need to do in order to achieve that dream of the 2.5 kids in the white picket fence is that you show up for work and you save and you do all these types of things. But there are many examples of creative people who don't do that much work, who come up with one genius idea, and this idea transforms into such a large amount of money that they don't have to think about work ever again for their lives. Think of Mark Zuckerberg inventing Facebook, or a musician like Led Zeppelin creating some of their albums. These assets that they pull out of their imagination and create in reality bring to them incredible wealth for the rest of their lives. Their imagination sets them free and also liberates them from having to labor like everybody else. The people who lack the imagination are sadly stuck to having to conscientiously labor, show up every single day. Whereas Mark Zuckerberg can be a lazy boob sitting in his room playing video games all day, stoned out of his brain because of a genius idea he came up with a decade ago. That's the power of thinking big. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is going to be a little bit more self-help orientated. We're going to talk about how you can re-spark your imagination, how you can turn on your capacity to be creative, how you can develop this imaginative asset inside of your brain. We're going to talk about practical tips you can follow and various perspectives you can take on the problem so that we can get you bursting with explosions of color and opening up doors and portals towards vistas of never-ending power within inside your own mind. Now, at this point, you might say to yourself, Steph, I don't believe any of this nonsense. I don't have an imagination. And having an imagination is something that is genetically fixed. We cannot change this. If my brain cannot imagine, then I don't think I can develop it anymore. I don't even want to develop this imagination stuff. I think of artists, and I think of floppy, limp-wristed dorks who live inside smelly houses, sleeping on mattresses. I do not want this. I want to remain a wage slave. I want to remain working conscientiously every day. It gives my life order and structure. And even if I wanted to change, even if I did not want to be an NPC trapped within the Matrix, my mind cannot change. I am not born with an imagination, so I will die without one, and you cannot fix that in me, so don't give me false hope. Now, I disagree with this sentiment. I disagree with this idea that people do not have a natural capacity to imagine at a very high level. Every night when you go to sleep, you dream. Your mind creates imaginary scenes inside of your head, and you participate in them almost like they're a world that you cannot even tell from reality itself. You do that 7 times a night on average, and you're trying to tell me that you don't have the capacity to use that faculty within your mind while you're awake. You have the ability to do this. But nonetheless, I understand why people can feel this sentiment, because I actually lost my imagination at one point in my life. You see, when I was a kid, I was like most other kids, very imaginative. I could play pretend. I could get a stick and pretend it was a sword. I can imagine scenes. I was hanging out in the garden and turning the garden into this wonderful world that I could participate in that was a part of Lord of the Rings or something like that, and I was fighting all the orcs by myself around an apple tree. I could summon that stuff up inside of myself. In fact, I was particularly talented at being imaginative. I remember my mom would always show me stacks of paper that I drew when I was younger. And on these stacks of paper, there was this giant schema for this alternate other alien planet that I had created inside of my mind, and I built out this whole civilization and the story about what the civilization was. I had this incredible ability to create vistas and portals and giant imaginary spaces, this giant ability for me to escape off into other worlds in and of themselves. And my experience of life, of course, was very vivid and very, very joyful and full of color and full of life. As I was going through my youth, I remember going through all these experiences. I remember all these games I would play with people, and it was always so vivid. They stick inside of my memory so much. Everything's so full of color, all those scenes, all those moments, so full of so much energy. But as I went through my teenage years and participated in the school system, I lost this capacity to imagine to a very dramatic extent. Now, what's interesting is I didn't notice myself losing this. I didn't notice myself running out of the ability to be genuinely creative, to have that seriousness of a child at play, as Nietzsche said, to have that confidence of childhood in your ability to just project your imagination upon the world. And instead, when I got into school and I went through the schooling system, I became sterilized. Something happened which turned my mind off, and I lost that ability to be naturally creative and imaginative. And I didn't notice this till I was basically in college, till I was coming into my 20s. But I look back now at my school years and I notice some problems that are starting to pop up that are very strange for an imaginative kid to have. So I took up guitar, I started playing music when I was in school, and I found it very hard to write my own songs, to create my own ideas. I found that the best I could really do was I could copy other singers that I liked, like the Red Hot Chili Peppers or something like this, and I would have to buy their guitar, and I had to buy the guitar that Jimi Hendrix had. I had to mimic these people, and I couldn't sit down and make my own tune, so I had to make songs, and if I wanted to make a song, I'd have to like copy one of their processes and do it. And I found it very, very difficult to break out of that pattern. If I used to go into English class, and I was very, very good at English class and fiction writing, but I'd always have to sort of steal my ideas from somewhere because I couldn't generate them properly from myself. I didn't have this connection to this part of my brain that exploded up this well, this foundation of original thoughts. I didn't even realize I was missing that because it was like something that was turned off. You know, it's like a muscle that's turned off, and because it's turned off, you don't really notice that you can't use it until it's turned on. Now, when I got into college, I started to have an awful lot of problems with this because I was a young man. I was trying to find my identity. I was trying to understand who I am, where I stand among people. And of course, a big part of college, especially if you're going into artistic scenes like the humanities and stuff like this, is that your conception of yourself is that you want to have style, you want to have character, you want to present yourself as the individual that you are. And I really wanted to do that. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to put Steph out there into the world. I wanted to invent myself, to recreate myself, to become somebody, to, you know, fill in my shoes and go and assert myself upon reality. But I found that very, very difficult. I found it very difficult to put out my own songs, to create my own style, to, you know, decide like what type of clothes should I wear? How should I talk? How should I, you know, go about my artistic career? How am I going to write? What's the style I'm going to add to my writing? I was doing literature in college, and these were all actually very difficult problems for me, and I was essentially having an identity crisis trying to fit in because I felt I couldn't do it. And I had all sorts of weird ways of dealing with this because I really wanted to develop this original way of speaking, this original way of presenting myself. I really wanted to develop all these things, but because this imagination of mine was turned off and I didn't realize it was turned off, I was trying my best, but in this screwed up way. So I would sit down and I would get like Dostoevsky, or I get Nietzsche, or I get poets that are like William Blake, and I try to copy their phrases, their best quotes, you know? I was one of those quote cells. I would try to copy their best quotes, and I would try to say them in my own words. I would try to take their quote and maybe, you know, maybe leave a commentary underneath it, or explain what the quote meant or something like this. Again, I would try to make music, but I would try to copy what I saw other people doing. And in general, I felt this very frustrated impotence that I wasn't able to be creative, that I wasn't able to make things that were my own, even things like my humor, you know, my humor, my jokes, my way of presenting myself, the words that I would use, the songs that I would make, the stuff that I would write. It never really felt like it had my voice. I felt like a boy without a tongue, sort of mannequin without a personality. I felt like there was a thing, a soul trapped inside of this fake plastic body, and it couldn't talk. I couldn't get it to release its voice. I was in a very, very dire place, and I was not in a good place at this time either. My mind was all scrambled, egged, and screwed up. Psychedelics were involved in that as well. But this was the main existential problem that I was having. I was really trying to give birth to my own original perspective, voice, and my capacity to think for myself. But I couldn't do it. Now, during this period, during these college years, a very significant set of experiences happened for me with psychedelics. Now, I don't want to say psychedelics are what made me imaginative, because that's actually not true. I'm going to get to more technical things later on that are really fun and really almost like a jungle gym, almost like going to the gym for your brain. We'll get to that in a moment. But this is a very significant part of the story for several reasons. So let's get into it properly. So think about all the existential problems I'm having here. I don't know where I fit within the social world. I'm trying to come up with a personality, but I'm presenting myself, but I really struggle with this. I can't really put myself out there. I'm having this sort of like identity crisis. You know, I'm going through some schizo stuff, growing up to become a young man. Don't know where I fit in the world. Don't know what my voice is. I'm trying to give birth to my voice. Now, during this period, I took LSD for the first time and I had a bad trip. My first go, cursed to have a bad trip. And I essentially got the fear. I became afraid of drugs in an extremely serious way. I had this detachment experience where I began to believe that I lived in a cartoon. I began to feel that there was this separation between me and the world. Nothing felt real. I started to transform into a Gnostic. I would look at things on the street and it was almost like I was living inside of a lucid dream or something like that. And I would see things flicker and I'd say to myself, am I going crazy? Is this LSD coming back again? Has it lodged itself in my brain and I'm having repeat trips or something like this? Am I going insane? Did I take the LSD and did it chew out a part of my brain and I'm now permanently damaged forever? I was worried about all these types of things. And I got attacked with this really serious fear. I essentially got post-traumatic stress disorder off taking LSD, off letting something mess with my mind and not being able to be in control of it. And so I started having this disassociative problem where, as I said, everything felt fake and I would touch things sometimes and I would like the sensations would go up into my brain and say, that's not real. And it would start to screw my brain an awful lot. Now, that's actually not too relevant. The main problem with this is that it put me in this very paranoid state. I was stuck inside of my head. I felt like I didn't have this voice. I was afraid. I thought I did something wrong to my brain because of things like psychedelics. I didn't know where I fitted in the world. I was very frustrated. I was very despairing. I didn't really know what to do at all. And at some point, I said to myself, I can't live like this. There has to be a way I can break out of this problem that I'm having. I'm stuck essentially in this mental illness crisis. I feel like I'm going crazy and I'm afraid all the time. I've got like anxiety disorder. I'm in panic. I'm basically depressed, basically always anxious. There's something ripping me apart from the inside here. I have no soul. I can't assert myself. I can't create anything. I'm a copycat. I have no voice. I hate myself. I'm not happy with myself. There was all this terrible, terrible energy swirling inside of me as I was trying to discover how to become who I'd become. And at one point I said to myself, listening to people like Terence McKenna probably didn't help with this that much. I said to myself, I have to face the thing that destroyed me. I have to face the thing that I'm afraid of. This is the Jungian hero's journey. I was saying to myself, right, I must go back towards the dragon in the darkness. And so I said, you know what I got to do is I've got to take LSD again. Now, you might say to yourself, Steph, maybe, I don't know about this. It's like the car crash broke your leg and you're like, I need to get her in another car crash. But there was definitely logic to this. And there's definitely something about you being able to face something that intimidated you before, where you get power over it once again. And so I got obsessed with this idea of me taking LSD in the most intense way possible and facing it in my mind by myself. And so what I did is I went to North Dublin. North Dublin is like the dodgy, dangerous part of Dublin. And I went to North, and I was down to South Dublin. I was a fucking South Dublin wanker, posh wanker. So I went up to North Dublin and I found a drug dealer who I could buy my own LSD off. And so I bought a heroic dose, which is 500 micrograms. It was a very, very strong dose. I think my first dose was probably like 50 to 100 micrograms. This is now 5 times, maybe even 10 times as much. So this was just going to absolutely blow my socks off if I took this stuff. And I went and I did this and I bought it, and then I went home one summer back to the countryside and I decided I was going to take the entire dose by myself with nobody around to save me in nature in the countryside. And so that's what I did. Now, the morning of this trip, my poor parents were there, but they were going for a day trip down to the south of Ireland, you know, so they're God bless them. If they ever find out about this, please don't tell them that, because I'm going to get in so much trouble. I didn't get battered. It doesn't matter if I'm a grown man at this point. I think the wooden spoon would be whipped out and I'll get a wallop in if they ever find out about this. But they went down to the south of the country and I was there by myself in the countryside, in the farmlands. And I was like, all right, let's go. I was so afraid. I was absolutely bricking it. Standing there, you know, like a movie scene, holding these three tabs of acid or something like this. I can't remember exactly what it was. It might have been 3, 4, 2, something like this. Whatever way they split it. And I'm staring at these things and I'm like, oh my God, here we go. And I took them. And I went out and I waited in the garden and I was with my dog. So it was like an adventure with me and my dog. And this acid has this sort of slow come up. So it takes about an hour and a half to really kind of kick into gear. Now, this did not take an hour and a half. This started to kick into gear in like 15 minutes. All of a sudden, I could just feel that shit ramping up. Like I was clicking into fifth gear almost immediately. And I was like, whoa, I'm in for a big one, lads. Oh my God, here we go. And I just got this unmitigated urge to just go wander into the farmlands in the forest. And that was a bit of a dangerous thing because the farmlands in Ireland are full of like bulls, and I almost got killed by bulls about 3 or 4 times while I was doing this. Now, as I was going out, this acid trip was so strong that it completely just annihilated any mental resistance I could have to it. I was so afraid, but fear almost got dissolved into just pure intensity. There was no conception of fear. There was no conception of resistance. It was in some sense a very feminine experience where I just had to give in to the reality. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't put up, I couldn't defend myself from it anymore. It was too powerful. And the really the, what made this happen is that I was having these explosive visions, probably literally like a Beatles music video or something like this. I was seeing these giant faces appearing out of the sky and all these snakes cross across the ground and they're swarming around. I was, you know, my eyes were like fully dilated, I imagine. And I was like, what is going on? Oh my God. And this lasted for hours. I was absolutely blasted out of my tits having these extreme visions for hours and hours and hours. And it was a crazy experience. I'll talk about it another time. But when I came back home at the end of it, you know, my parents actually showed up and I was still like out of my face at that point. I remember saying to my mom, she came in the room, she's like, how are you doing? And I'm like, everything's all right. So I was still pretty gone. But I remember towards the end of it, something happened inside of me. So the intensity came and I just kind of gave into the experience. I was having all these visions. But towards the end of it, as things was calming down, but I was still in that sort of liminal space of being absolutely twisted out of my mind, I whipped out my notepad and I just started to, it was like I was channeling. It was like there was an explosion of colorful fire inside the back of my mind. There's this explosion of dreams inside of my mind. And I could see these images inside of my head and I could just scribble them down. And I was writing down all these images and I started writing poems. Actually, if you look up on YouTube, I believe there's one called Ion. It was one of the poems that came out during this experience. There is a voice within the deep. You can check it out. It's there somewhere. And there's a lot of other things that came out as well. And all these pictures that I started to draw. I was having this problem. Oh my God, here's another problem I was having. I was trying to learn to draw. And when I would draw, I would have to take a graph of something I liked and stencil it out and then put it on, just color it in, because I couldn't come up with original forms. But during this experience, I was drawing the things that I saw during the trip. And I had this imagination inside of my head. There's this imagistic, this vortex of images inside of my head that wasn't there before was turned on. This like golden explosion of images. And I was drawing pictures of what I was seeing. And I was amazed. I was like, oh my God. I didn't even realize initially what was happening until I woke up the next day and looked at the notepad and thought about what just happened. And it says, oh my God, I switched on that imagination. And I remembered that feeling from childhood. And it reminded me of that. And I remembered looking at the notepad and it reminded me of what I used to do when I was a kid. I had switched this imagination back on. Now, this was very significant because it showed me that there was something that I was missing that could be turned back on. All of a sudden, this existential crisis that I was having as a young 20-year-old had now shifted to a new paradigm. No longer was my problem that there was something wrong with me, that I didn't have my own voice, that I didn't have my own perspective. Now, I realized that I was lacking something before. I had lived for years in a reality that was gray, is what I was describing it as. Everything had lost its numinance, its luminosity. There's the fancy, there's some jargon for you. Everything had been sucked of its imaginative qualities, and I'll get into what I mean by that later. And I was living in this very, very mentally unwell, depressed, anxious, paranoid place where I struggle with my own individuality and my own originality. And I had all this potential that I was missing out on. And all of a sudden, this imagination switched on and everything changed. I could see the world around me, these simple things as like the farmland around me as this glorious place where the gods lived. I had this explosion of creative dreams inside of my head that gave me my own voice. I had images inside of my head that I could paint that were from me. I didn't have to copy other people. I had this waterfall, this fountain exploding out of me. And all of a sudden, I was a child once again. And it was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. It gave me my soul back. Now, what's interesting is that faded away. It was very strong for about 4-6 weeks afterwards. I was walking around like ditzy out of my nyuk. But then eventually it started to fade because it's not permanent and it's not going to stay. It's drug induced. And so that started to fade and that grayness started to settle back in again. And I was a little bit worried about that. I was like, oh my God, I'm going back to what I was before. But I wasn't as worried because now there was something new in its place. Now there was something I had seen that I could not unsee. I understood the problem. And I began to understand that bravery was a big part of this. And this is something that I want you to really think about, is that not only was the psychedelic probably switching on some part of making parts of my brain talk to each other that didn't talk to each other before, but I was afraid. And fear is an incredible stimulant. And I dived into one of the most hardcore fears I had, pretty much the biggest fear I had at the time. And I launched myself into that, and I got this incredible boon and reward as a consequence. And I've noticed later in my life, from doing things like boxing and going and doing things that intimidate me, talking to girls that I find extremely beautiful that are intimidating, I've always noticed that I get this jolt, this burst of creative power when I put myself into fear. So I think there's something to that as well. But all of these things wrapped up together, the fear that I leaped into, the bravery it took me to do this, showed me how to switch on, that imagination could turn on. That's what I saw. But it faded away. But I knew it was there. And then over that next year, basically, I made some very big decisions in my life. That's when I decided to drop out of college, because I realized that me participating in this, for a variety of different reasons, but this is one of them, is that it was taking something from me. It was making me less. It was making me pathetic. It was making me weak. It was turning me into a grayscale, soulless person without an anima, without an imagination. And I decided I wanted to break out and I wanted to go on a path where I would cultivate this inside of myself. And I started to think about this. I was like, how could I switch that part of my imagination on? I had it when I was a kid, so I don't want to go down this path where I take a load of psychedelics. I don't want to go down this path where I take all these drugs. There must be a way that I can turn this capacity on without using these drugs. There must be a way that I can do this. Now, there was a cascade of things happening to me at this point in my life. I was choosing to leave college. I was choosing to go my own way. I was starting to take much more braver decisions. I really started to figure out my identity and figure out who I was. I started to assert myself an awful lot more. I began to break free from an awful lot of people who I was friends with, who were taking these drugs as like party tools, and they had this relationship with them that I didn't want to have. I wanted to understand. I understood that I had just received a message that this creative spark was in me and I could bring that out, but the drugs were not the path to that. I knew that I could develop this, and so I started to move away from them. And I started to change my life in all sorts of ways. And so I went and I dropped out of college, moved into this tiny little crappy box apartment, slept on a mattress by myself, very Jim Morrison style, you know, living in this rooftop. It was very romantic. Well, in some sense it was. It was kind of grungy in others. And all I had was my books, a couple of books, and I had a little bit of cash that I could spend on finding mentors and singers and poets and people like this, and I'd like, you know, go to kickboxing gyms and go to the gym and stuff like this. And so this is where I found myself at this point in my life. And so I dropped out, set myself up, and I began to search for ways that I could develop my intellectual capacities. Now, I began to expand myself in all sorts of ways. I went to music classes. I went to singing classes to try to find my voice. I wanted to develop myself this way. I worked on speaking skills. I worked on the gym, but we can forget about those things. But there's this general ethos of self-improvement and building, which I think is very important. It really gets the right attitude underneath this. But in this intellectual sphere, my big focus was, how do I switch on that creative imagination again? I knew that there was some experience that I had where all these images were exploding inside of my mind, and I knew that I had to find that again. And the first place I came across something that started to give me leeway or headway with this was Carl Jung. Now, I had been reading many of the great thinkers of the Western canon, from Plato all the way up to Nietzsche, and Jung was one of the people I was very interested in getting to know. Now, I have a much different take on Jung than most people. When most people come across Jung, they get bewitched by his conceptual frameworks. They love this idea of the archetypes, and they think it's Pokemon, where they're going to go and they're going to learn about all the archetypes and build these archetypes inside of their head and model their mind or something like this and learn about all these archetypes and it's going to improve them. And they come up with all these esoteric phrases like individuation, and it all becomes very, very weird. It becomes very intellectual and very sterile and very lifeless, and ultimately Jungians are famous for being a little bit kind of like batshit crazy and not really worth listening to. Now, I have never liked that side of Jung. I've never really got into that side of Jung. I've definitely explored these ideas, but I was finding in Jung something much, much different. I was hearing Jung talk about this part of our minds that is hidden from us, that he would call the unconscious, that can switch on and show us symbols and give us intuitions and give us dreams. And it essentially should be treated as this separate personality that lives inside of ourselves that we need to learn to build a relationship with and respect. He's basically saying that you're schizophrenic, you have this dreaming, powerful force inside of your head, the unconscious, that you need to learn to talk to. And the way it talks to you is via images, it's via symbols, via moods, via artistic tastes, via attraction towards certain musical types and things like this. There's something inside of you that wants to express itself. And he would describe it to me exactly like what I thought I was seeing. I realized that something switched on inside of me. And I was like, is this what Jung is talking about? That this whole idea of individuating is that you develop the relationship with your unconscious and everything starts to work. And I started to get that hunch that that's what he was talking about. It's a weird way to read Jung, but I actually think it's the most accurate, or maybe the most practical way to read him. And I was always scouring through his stuff, and I was like, Carl, just get to the fucking point, man. Like, what are we banging on about the mother archetype for? And what are we banging on about individuation for? And what are we banging on about the shadow? Just give me the juice. Like, what do I do to make this happen? I don't want to know. I want to do. I want action. This is very much where I was in my life as well. I was sick of, you know, being in the colleges and being among academics and them drilling me full of jargon, turning me into a NPC little dork. Like, I didn't want that stuff anymore. And so I was scouring through Jung, and I found inside of Jung just this very subtle implication about dream reading. Jung said that you can sit down and you can read your dreams. And if you read your dreams, it will stimulate the process of individuation and get your unconscious mind to begin to unite with your ego. This is the phraseology that he was talking about. But I began to understand that is that I am the ego, and this imaginative, powerful force that I switched on, if I go and read my dreams, it will reforge that connection between my ego and my unconscious, and I will experience a much more stable and permanent ignition of my imagination. And so what I did is I began to wake up every single morning, and I began to write down my dreams. I had a little notepad that I had beside my bed, and I would roll over and scribble what was in my mind in there. And it was the second I would wake up, I would flip over and I would start writing. I would just brain dump. And there's this really weird thing where something happens with your neurochemistry where you think that dreams are nonsense. You think that, like, it's not interesting. It's just another boring day, you know, so you don't want to write it down. You want to forget about it and get on with your day. And you're sort of geared towards forgetting about your dreams and moving on, and all the chemistry inside of your brain pushes those dreams out of relevance. But when you actually write them down and then go and get breakfast and come back and look at them, you'll actually be amazed at how weird and how interesting these dreams often are. So this would be my first procedure. Now, it's not the most practical procedure. You're going to notice about this presentation that I go from the most schizo possible ways that you can increase your imagination by facing your fears and taking psychedelics to dream reading, which is, I guess, at least a little bit more stable. But then eventually, later on, I'm going to talk to you about much more sophisticated and straightforward ways that you can do this that are more down to earth. But hey, live a little, man. Try something a little bit schizo. You never know. Maybe your dreams, there might be something cool happening inside of them. Who knows? You're only going to live once. May as well check out some dreams. Stop being a fucking square. Now, an awful lot of very interesting things would happen when you try to read your dreams. First of all, you develop this very good habit of not having your electronics around your bed, so you're not waking up in the morning and immediately going on your phone. I didn't have a phone at that point because I was too goddamn broke, so it was pretty good. I would wake up and all I had was the paper and the pen. I wasn't staring at the phone when I go to sleep. And the first things that I would interact with are not me whipping this thing out and seeing what Twitter is saying or seeing what YouTube is saying and having other people's ideas install inside of my head. Instead, the first thing that would happen is I would open up inner Twitter. I would open up the Twitter from the astral plane. I would open up YouTube from within the soul. And the first ideas I would interact with were from my own imagination and my own soul. And I really think there's something to that. It would develop that connection with that imaginary part of myself. So it encourages good sleeping habits. It has this very interesting relationship towards inner creativity and speaking to your own soul instead of going to the internet or something like this. And I remember around about this period of my life, there was this idea always floating in my mind that there's nothing of value in the internet or in knowledge or in books that I need that I could not find within myself. This is a very Jungian idea in some sense, that there's something very resourceful and deep within me, and that if I was locked in a jail cell forever and I had nothing but my own soul, my own imagination, I could still stimulate myself and I could still observe realities about the world and still come to understand the world by exploring myself. There's something deeply valuable in here. And all of a sudden, this journey I was on to read all these books started to seem an awful lot less important to me. And I started to realize that I've got this book, this compression of DNA from the collective unconscious that is I'm carrying around within all my skin cells that I need to unpack. So I started to develop this very healthy attitude towards me, towards what I needed to do. I started to realize that, oh my God, my problem is not that I'm not creative anymore. I realized that I have so much stuff inside of myself that I need to try pull out. And this really blows your mind when you start to dream read, because every night you'll have 1 to 5 dreams and you just start to explode with these dreams. Some people will have less, some people aren't geared as much this way. But when you start to read them, you start to develop this ability to get more and more and more of them. My first couple of ones would be very short, and then all of a sudden it just starts to happen. You start to get 2-3 long, complex dreams every single night. They're orchestrated like these narratives, and some of them have this profound meaning inside of them. And so you're waking up in the morning, brain dumping these dreams, and then reading them later and just being absolutely floored. It's like somebody writing poetry about your life, only the person writing it is from a mental asylum. They're absolutely crazy. And so all these brilliant things happen from doing this dream reading process. My sleep gets better. I develop this way healthier attitude towards consuming my soul and then being creative with that, as opposed to being a Twitter cell, an NPC who just receives information from the outside world. But most importantly for me, that visual imagination that I saw with the psychedelics began to turn on stably and permanently. I began to notice it all the time. I would be out and I'd be talking to people and I'd get in conversations and I'd start to tell a story and I'd notice that visual space inside of the back of my mind would open up and I'd be telling somebody the story and I could see the images of what I was trying to talk about inside of my head. I did not have that before. The imagination was back. In fact, now that I talk on YouTube, oftentimes people say, "Steph, how do you just rant for hours and remain somewhat stable and coherent?" Well, it's actually because what I'm seeing inside of my head is this rush of images, and I'm almost like painting. I'm using my mouth like a brush to articulate for you the images that I'm seeing inside of my mind. I can see this period of my life as I'm talking. I can see the room. I can see the stanky, dirty mattress that I used to live on. I can see the red, sort of maroon red carpet. I'm seeing this stuff inside of my head as I'm talking to you. I'm seeing the notepads. I'm seeing the gray pencil that I wrote it in. I'm seeing the images that I drew down. It's all there inside of my imagination because it's now switched on. And so whatever Jung was talking about, him suggesting that I need to develop this relationship with my unconscious, I believe I actually started to have that. I started to have this really advanced interaction with this dreaming part of my mind. And it goes an awful lot more than just this visual imagination. Because of course, your unconscious talks back. It's telling you stories. And so you listen to these stories, you read these dreams, and you spend your time trying to articulate them to yourself. And it really starts to present you ideas that are a little bit uncanny. They predict things in your life. All these weird things would happen, you know, where you're reading a story and it would have a certain mood or something like this, or maybe some type of ironic problem would show up, or a certain scene would happen and then it would happen in your life. A lot of stuff like that would happen. You kind of thin the veil between this world and the next when you're playing around with your dreams an awful lot. And so you're definitely having a conversation with something out there, something very, very creepy. But that was not my goal. I was not trying trying to turn into some LARPing mystic. I was simply trying to switch on that creative imagination, and I was given that reward. My unconscious, my dreaming mind, whatever you want to call it, it seemed like it was happy enough that I was just talking to it at all. So it started to give me this superpower, and that creative imagination switched on and it stayed on. And even times where I would stop dream reading, even times where I'd forget to do it, or maybe life took over, or, you know, when I got this first and I couldn't help staring at it when I woke up in the morning, all of a sudden that dreaming imagination was still there. Something had changed in me. It was different than the drugs. It was different than psychedelics. Psychedelics was a glimpse, but this was different. This was something that changed what I was. It seems like I had rewired my brain, and I actually have a theory about what happened. Now, my theory about what is happening here is based on the neuroscience of the hemispheres. I believe that what I was doing was getting my right hemisphere and my left hemisphere to talk to each other in a way that they hadn't done before. You can think of it, again, like the gym, where people have muscle-building potential, and somebody who goes to the gym and starts to lift the weights will get that stimulus and get that response and watch their muscles grow. And it's the same with our brains. Our hemispheres exist inside of us. Our brain is split in half. It has two hemispheres, and these two hemispheres don't actually talk to each other this much. They're not really in dense communication all the time, and you can actually get the two of them to talk to each other and form better relationships, which basically will probably enhance the way that your brain functions. And these two hemispheres have dramatically different roles in your brain, and so if you did something like this and it actually worked, you would probably experience inside of yourself a different mode of consciousness. And this is exactly what I experienced, isn't it? I was living in this sort of grayscale reality. And then all of a sudden I did this procedure, and this procedure, first of all, I took psychedelics, and the psychedelics made my brain communicate to each other. It made my mind talk. And I had this experience of this imagination switching back on. But then that faded away because maybe this temporary ability was not going to last. But then I started to do this procedure of dream reading, and it made the two of them permanently start to talk to each other. How fascinating, how powerful that is. And that goes to show you that there could be something to this that we need to pay attention to. Now, I got an awful lot of my ideas off this from Ian McGilchrist. Ian McGilchrist was a neuroscientist and a philosopher who thinks an awful lot about the hemispheres and what they might mean. And he presents some very fascinating evidence and very fascinating suggestions about what our brain hemispheres are doing. And the one that struck me the most is how he demonstrated that the two hemispheres have dramatically different personalities and characters and functions. If you want to think about this simply, if you want to make a baby, you're not going to need two men or two women. That's not how it works. What you need to do is you need to get two dramatically different entities, fallen man and crazy psychotic woman. You need to get these two forces and make them mate and make them breed. Two entities that fundamentally don't understand each other, that represent the male and female polarity in the world, and you need to get them to cross over and blend together. And for some strange reason, because they're so opposite, it allows them to create something new that is unified. There's something magical that happens in their polarity, in their duality. And your brain is designed the same way. This is a hermetic law of the universe, you know? We tend to deal in polarization. We have two hands, and if you learn to box, you realize that the two hands have different functions. If you're gonna, you know, get in relationships, it's the same thing once again. There would be a masculine and a feminine. And for this reason, you have to understand that your brain operates on similar principles. Now, it's not that your brain is masculine and feminine, but it's that your brain has different roles. And so the left side of your brain, for example, has the language center. We know it as the Broca's area or the Wernicke's area. And this is the conscious language processing. I'm basically talking to you from my left hemisphere right now. And your left hemisphere is also your conscious part of your brain. It's the part of your brain that is right now self-aware. It's the part of your brain that right now is focused on paying attention to what I'm saying and processing the language that I'm talking about. The part of my brain that is currently paying attention to the black hole of the camera that I'm talking to and paying attention to you and trying to articulate my ideas in this way. Now, that whole conscious reality, that little tunnel, I think inside my head that that's me, that's Steph, that's my whole personality. But there's a very big problem. You think the same thing. There's actually this whole other brain somewhere else inside there that is doing all this stuff in the background right now that you are not noticing, that you are not paying attention to. And it's basically the right hemisphere. It's the other part of your head. It can't talk. It doesn't have a language processing center. It does actually in its own specific way, but we'll get into that later. It is essentially separate. It is all, the best way I could describe it is it's unconscious, or it's hidden from our conscious awareness. Now, it's kind of hard for people to mentally model this, but weirdly, if you take Ian McGilchrist and you collage it and clash it with psychoanalysis, like someone like Carl Jung, you get a very, very easy way to understand this. You essentially have this ego, which is this conscious left hemisphere, and then you have this unconscious, which is the right hemisphere, which seems like they fit very neatly together. I'm sure Ian would have take many issues with this, and it's definitely botching all the Jung stuff. You get a load of Jungians start to squeeze their nipples and get into a rage about this type of thing. But this is what I see when I look at these things. Now, what's fascinating is that what was Jung trying to tell you when you want to individuate? You want to try to get these two polarized forces to begin talking together. Just like when you're in a relationship, you want to make sure that, you know, there's sexual chemistry, there's communication chemistry going on, there's flirting, there's energy, there's chemistry in general happening between the two forces. If there's no chemistry, no magic can happen. Now, it's the same inside of your brain. If your conscious little left brain is running around being a useless dork who thinks he knows everything and not paying attention to the unconscious, not integrating with that, well, then you have a problem. Now, what's fascinating is that you have this little channel in between your two hemispheres that connects the two of them together, that has all these nerves that make them talk. Now, what's very interesting about this is that Ian McGilchrist is fronting a quite surreal idea that we have a conscious personality and an ego in this left hemisphere, but we also have another personality living inside of our own brains that can talk to us. It can communicate to us. Usually it's going to use symbols, it's going to use feelings, it's going to use intuitions. This is how the right hemisphere communicates. It can't use direct language in the way that left hemisphere can. It's not a language processor in the same way. It's actually much more of a schizophrenic artist living on the other side of your head. It's very close to what we understand as the symbolic creative imagination. And it's a different personality. People have cut their brains in half because of various reasons, like people having epilepsy. And then scientists have sat down with these people and spoken to both sides of their brains and getting different answers out of the same person. It seems like there's two entities inside your head. Do you understand what this means? And so the Jungian framework and model follows along with this perfectly. Jung says that we have this ego, but there is also this unconscious, which has agency, which has a will, which has a personality and character of its own. Oftentimes it can have many personalities and characters. And the struggle for us as an ego is that we need to learn how to integrate with this unconscious, to develop a relationship with some force inside of our heads in order for us to create a more holistic brain, a more holistic person, a more holistic experience. And so what I'm asserting is that if you can get the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere to communicate together, you were actually doing this Jungian individuation job in this very interesting and down-to-earth and practical way. And we actually know with copious amounts of evidence already that this is possible. For example, musicians, famously, before they start playing music, tend to have more separated, divergent brain hemispheres. But after they've played music for a long time, their brain hemispheres begin to tightly wire together and communicate better. Music transforms your brain. Plato said in his project to develop his great republic of eugenic supermen that all children have to go through a course of learning music before they are 12 years old. We actually see that if you learn music before the age of 12, I think Erval was talking about this, if you learn music before the age of 12, it can raise the IQ potential of a child up a standard deviation. It seems to just improve their brain. There's something objective about this. It does something to our heads. It seems like music has some type of harmonizing or magical effect on the brain that causes the hemispheres to communicate. And we see this in the studies of the brain scans. We see these musicians have a denser connection between the two. It does something here that is important. Good Lord, we're into Plato now already. This is turning into an Andrew Huberman podcast where he dropped a load of mushrooms and is channeling the spirit of Nietzsche or something. And so to bring this all back, the reason why I think the dreams are such a big deal is because we have evidence, we have studies, we have seen the brain scans where the right hemisphere is involved in the dreaming process. Now, the evidence for this is a bit scant, but I am willing to hypothesize. I'm willing to front the suggestion that if people look, they'd find more and more into this. So when you recall a dream after you wake up, which is exactly what I was doing in this process, this form of Jungian therapy that I was doing, the right hemisphere is the part of your brain that generates the memory of the dream, and it seems to present this memory to the conscious waking left hemisphere. So when you wake up and you go into your reality, what the left hemisphere is designed to do is to keep you narrowly focused on conscious tasks that you should be doing, and the right hemisphere shifts into the background and you go about your day and, you know, you do your normal things. The right hemisphere switches on. When you recall a dream, the right hemisphere just turns on. Now, that's weird in and of itself, because the right hemisphere only does that for very specific reasons. It goes from being a background figure to being this sort of foreground figure where all of a sudden it turns on. And then what the person experiences inside of your head is that you're seeing the dream again. You're seeing the dream that you had when you're asleep. Now, think about what that's trying to tell you. So maybe it's just stored there. Maybe the right hemisphere doesn't generate it. This could just be cope I'm making up. But it could also be the case that this is actually what happens when you go to sleep. You go to sleep, you're in that sort of semi-conscious space, and the dreams are coming out of the right hemisphere. God knows, maybe the right hemisphere is trying to process your day or do something when it's generating these dreams. God knows what it means, but this is what it looks like. So when you recall your dreams, your right hemisphere articulates them, presents them to you. Now, I think the reason why I got so much benefits out of doing what I did is because I was crossing the boundary in its final sense. First of all, I was recalling the dreams, so that alone was almost like training the right hemisphere to switch on and getting the two of them to talk together. And then I was trying to transfer those dreams into articulate language, and we're going to start getting into this side of things an awful lot more. So I was waking up and then getting my notepad, and I was writing down what I was seeing, forcing myself to memorize it, number one, and then writing down what I was seeing in the left hemisphere's forte, which is language. I was learning to do that properly, and that, I believe, started to cross the gray matter in my brain, started to get my corpus callosum communicating tightly, building these big bridges between the two brains, because I was taking the forte, the fields of both of these forces, and getting them to communicate. So the right hemisphere generates this weird, dreamy, hazy, symbolic language. I was remembering this, and then I was packaging it in conceptual language and pulling it down into reality and putting it on paper. And I would also do this thing where later on I would go back to the dreams and I would try to free associate off the various things that were happening there. So I would try to expand the dream. So if I had a dream about something in a swamp, I would try to draw pictures of what I was seeing. I would try to write things down. I would try to expand the vision a little bit more. I tried to color in the broader idea. I'd let the dream manifest more. So I was encouraging the right hemisphere to come out and finish the dream off while I was awake. And I would get into these sort of trance states where I'd be painting these big pictures. They were very badly drawn because I'm not a fantastic visual artist, and it was like drawn with pencil as well, and you know the pencil would fade and I would be too lazy to fucking pare the pencil, so it would come out with all this squashed nonsense. But I was encouraging this part of my imagination to show itself, this right hemisphere, to show me the dream world, and then I was articulating all this stuff and it started to crystallize an awful lot more. And so I think that's what was causing this effect to happen. And this gave me this, the result from this is that I had a permanent transformation in my capacity to use my imagination in every part of my life. So now let us take one baby step closer to something practical, because the next step on my journey was coming across Conor McGregor and his love for visualization. So in 2015-16, Conor McGregor was just about reaching its apex and his peak, and he was always talking about the power of visualization. He was big into The Secret, and The Secret was this thing where you sit down and you go out to your garage and you visualize a Lamborghini sitting there, and you can say to yourself, well, you visualize it and you have the courage to speak it and you will manifest it. It was big into this manifestation stuff, and a lot of people call this woo-woo, but I don't believe it's woo-woo at all. I think it is extremely powerful, because first of all, to have that capacity to visualize, you're essentially training your imagination to do this job that we're talking about doing. And I think it really benefited Conor in his ability to succeed, and I was absolutely captivated by this. Now, I can also think of rational reasons why it worked so well for him. I don't want to write off the mystical reasons, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But even his habit of always trying to visualize, you know, having that supercar and having all the wealth and having the big house and all this, that's training his brain to be very good at creating imaginary spaces inside of his mind. And there is copious amounts of evidence that this is incredibly powerful for enhancing your ability to learn. To give you an example of this, they have many studies, but one study is they got a lot of basketball players and they got them to shoot free throws. Now, with their free throws, they had one group just practice free throws as they are. One group would just visualize, wouldn't practice at all, would just visualize. No physical practice, only mental practice. And the third group would practice and visualize at the same time. Now, then they got them all to do this test of free throws and see who would do the best. And of course, the people who practiced and visualized did the best. But the people who came second were the people who visualized only. And the group that came last were those who physically practiced only. Now, think about what that is trying to tell you. That the people who worked on their software did better than the people who worked on their hardware only. That's a big, big deal. And that's showing you something, that your enhanced learning can happen through visualization. In fact, it seems like the mental side of your ability to practice makes all the difference. Now, what were these people doing when they were visualizing? Well, this is literally mental training. So you don't move your body at all. Well, you can move your body if you want, but your focus is not on actually performing the repetition, but standing there or sitting down and mentally performing it inside of your head and thinking about the mechanics of the basketball and creating the experience inside of your head. Now we're getting somewhere very interesting. Your capacity to create a liminal space inside of your imagination, to create this area inside of your head, this dream inside of your head, and imagine all the people standing in front of you cheering, imagine the bright lights flickering inside of your eyes, bouncing the ball, and you're hearing in your imagination, I can hear it right now, the ball bouncing off the varnished wooden floors. You can see the tape of the red and yellow and white tape or whatever it is. You've got those dorky basketball shoes on. You've got the big felt and baggy basketball pants. You're bouncing it with your hand. You can feel the pressure go through your hand. Can you feel that pressure go through your hand? That's a big question. It comes back up again and you lift the ball up and you can feel, you've got this kinesthetic feeling that you can imagine inside of your head. This is how powerful your imagination needs to be. And you follow through and you experience the whole thing inside of your imagination. You feel each of those experiences, and then you recreate that in your head over and over and over and again, and you imagine the arc that it needs to go through in order for it to sink into the net, and you hear the whoosh and everything. Now, your capacity to do this and to sit down every single day and do this has a dramatic effect on your results. In that little study I told you about, the two groups that visualized succeeded. Not the group that physically practiced. One of the groups that physically practiced failed. The coefficient for success seemed to be related to this ability to mentally visualize. Both together are obviously the best, but this ability to mentally visualize is a big deal. And we see studies like this across the board, even with musicians. Musicians who are given a piece and they listen to the piece and then they imagine themselves playing the piece versus the ones who practice playing the piece. The ones who imagine it tend to learn it 4 to 5 times faster because they code in their brain the actual process and the actual arc of the sound. You know this as a musician. I'm a musician. And when I sat down and really spent a lot of time, actually around about this time is when I really started to dedicate much more time to learning how to hear music properly, learning how to create the songs inside of my head. I was learning at this point, I was doing all sorts of wild things where I was trying to learn how to hear a drum beat in my head and then create another musical instrument on top of it and then another one on top of it and try to create these musical instruments inside of my head so I could really, really develop that capacity to generate imaginative spaces inside of my head. And of course, all this dream reading and all these things really, really helped me. And so me coming across visualization, I began to look into it and I began to discover all this stuff, that it's a cheat code for enhanced learning. And of course, Connor was doing all this. He was doing this visualization with The Secret, and I'm sure he went into the gym then. And when he was in the gym, he was working, he was fighting, and then he would go home and he would imagine the fighting, and he would imagine himself, you know, he would imagine that right hand coming and he comes across with the counter left. He was imagining all these sequences and all these shots. You can hear him talk about this even today. Like, he's walking around, he's saying stuff like, do you know, people would be there, we'd be there walking around and someone's there talking to me. They're talking to me, but my head's not there. My head's not in that place. My head's in the middle of a sequence. My head's in the middle of a sequence. I'm knee deep inside of a rolling sequence, BJJ. I'm in the middle of throwing an uppercut or something like this. I'm in the middle of countering someone inside of my mind. I'm there, but not only there in person. My mind is somewhere else. My mind is focused on winning. This is what you hear him talk about, and this is exactly this skill that actually drives serious results in your life. This is how you become a competent professional in the thing that you want to focus on, the thing that you want to get good at. And so around about this time, I started to work on this. This dreaming seemed to give me this capacity to imagine, and all of a sudden, I started to get this practical skill that I began to invoke. I began to play then with my ability to learn music better, my ability to perform better in things like the gym. You know, like visualize yourself lifting weights. It's all the same thing. You can visualize pretty much anything if you want to get better at it. And in a very practical way, if you want to just think about the mechanics of performing something correctly, this is very, very important for you to learn. And I started to gain this essential superpower from doing this. Now, on top of this as well, I began to play around with the more mystical sides of things, like how I can imagine the future, how I can manifest things that I want. I'm not sure if you should play with this. Do not do this at home, kids, is basically my disclaimer here. But I was playing around with a lot of stuff. I was finding out about magic, all of these things, they kind of like pull you in these types of directions. I was discovering this idea of manifesting certain strange realities. I played around with magic and I decided to test this stuff. And so I said, show me a blue rose. I remember I did some type of like visualization magical spell to see a blue rose. Now, a blue rose is something that basically doesn't happen in nature, so it's very, very rare. And I remember casting, trying to manifest this visualization of this blue rose. And then I went, you know, out of my house and went down and went into the local flower shop the next day and asked, do they have any blue roses? And the person said, they looked at me like I had 20 heads and they're like, no, what are you talking about? Blue roses? Like, we have roses. Do you want them? Otherwise, leave me alone, you weirdo. You look broke. You probably can't even afford it. And so I left and I was like, all right, it's all crap. It's all bullshit. It doesn't make sense. Then 6 months later, I was inside a shop that I'd been inside basically every single day for about a year and a half to 2 years. And I had never spoken to any of the staff in that shop. Never once I had said hello or anything like that. Maybe when I was like checking out, I'd be like, hey, how are you doing? Nodding the head, that type of thing. But other than that, I basically never spoke to pretty much anybody there. And one day I was standing in the aisles and I got this firm tap on my shoulder. And I turned around and one of the staff members was holding a blue rose and handing it to me and saying, is this yours? And I was like, what? I couldn't believe that happened. To this day, I'm still a little bit like, I just have to categorize that one away as, you know, maybe I'll ask Sam Harris about it someday and be like, disprove this for me, my man. You know, help me out here. What's going on? So I was playing around with this stuff. And this is the type of things that began to happen. And I was like, all right, this is starting to get freaky. Dionysus Lives, if you listen to that song that I made, that was also a visualization. So I remember I sat down and I was imagining performing on stage, performing music. And I wrote Dionysus Lives basically as this poem, this visualized poem. And what's weird is that experience sort of happened for me. I ended up playing on stage at one point and it was quite a lot like that, you know. It was that experience of being in the moment and all this type of stuff, so it was pretty cool that came true. But also the song Dionysus Lives came out of it, and it showed me this very interesting side of creativity where I sat down one day, I imagined this scenario, this scene, and it transformed into this really, really fertile poem that had this really powerful energy. I remember just there was this gorgeous energy inside of that song. And then I remember that song just kind of came out of me one day then. I managed to shape it into a song and it just really clicked. And I absolutely love this song to this day. I listen to it and I'm like, man, I really, really like the way it turned out. And again, that's another example of like some interesting mystical creativity thing where not only did that experience essentially happen to me then later, but it also gave me a creative asset. It helped me make something in my life. So who knows? There's something there that you can experiment with. Be careful though. Be careful what you wish for is genuinely a good warning when it gets into these things. Now at this point in around about 2016, 2017, I was out of college a couple of years, but I was crusading quite well. My imagination was back on. It had fully sparked. But I had gotten to the point now where I was beginning to develop practical applications for this. It wasn't just me reading my dreams and being that weirdo who talks about his dreams all the time at the parties and stuff like this. Now, I was going to fight chimps. I was applying visualization techniques to try and make myself learn fighting better. I was working on my music and working on developing a more original style. And all of a sudden, my capacity to create original songs was showing up. My own musical imagination had switched on. I was developing that as well. So I was developing my ability to be musically independent and have my own musical voice. My creative energy was strong and abundant, and I had that childlike joy about me. I was always fun. I was always funny to talk to. My imagination was flying all the time. I would be prepared to go on big schizo rants if you so needed me to do. I had many things that I could talk about all the time, and I was developing this ability to sort of have a magical reality where I could go out outside, and it was almost like the dream world had integrated with the reality that I live in. So I was able to see what was fascinating and interesting about almost anything around me. This is the sort of maybe more subtle and hard to quantify effects, you know, but I could go down to the shop and I could crack jokes about, you know, the bagels in the store or something like this. But once your imagination comes back, you have this ability as a redeemer, as Dionysus, to lift up the quality of the world around you. You can create a wonderful world in the subtleties and the boringness and the humility of the reality right in front of you. You develop this ability to entertain yourself, entertain life, participate in life, be with life. And I was developing all of these skills, and so I started to develop a much better personality and started to enjoy myself an awful lot more and really become someone, really become who I am, I guess is the way that I could say it. And it was at this point that I found one of the most practical and down-to-earth tools that I've ever found in my life in developing my imagination and making this faculty inside of my brain better. And this came from the writing game. This came from me looking for people to train me how to be a better speaker, how to be a better writer, and how to be a better communicator. Now, I'm not sure exactly where I came across this. It was either an improvisational comedy class or a fiction writing class, a writing class. But I was told about this exercise, which was called object writing. It was used to develop better song lyrics, and I eventually developed it into what I call the flash. And this exercise had a fascinating thesis at the root of it that we're going to explain now. You see, the first principle of writing good fiction is about you understanding the difference between explaining or telling someone information and showing someone information using language. Now, to give you an example of this, think of the difference between Interstellar, the film, presenting physics ideas compared to a professor standing in front of a class of people explaining physics ideas. The physics professor might struggle to get 40 people into his lecture hall, and most of them are going to fall asleep and they're not even going to want to be there. Whereas all these people are going to go willingly and spend money, even though I know they spend money for college, but, you know, maybe their parents pay for that or the state or something like this. They're not really enthusiastic about it. Instead, in this instance, these people are going to spend money to go to a cinema theater and sit down, and they're going to be glued to the screen watching this physics story of Interstellar by Christopher Nolan. Like, why is that happening? This is because people want to see. They do not want to be told. They want to be shown. Think, for example, of somebody like Liver King. Liver King could come in and say, you should eat raw meat. You should take a load of steroids. You should become big and strong. You should be primal. You should be a wild man. And he could explain all this stuff via a blog or on Twitter or something like this. And he could explain it to you. And it could be all correct, but you're not going to be as compelled by it compared to you going into Instagram and seeing this dude in a giant Humvee with a machine gun gunning down his own cattle so he can eat their livers raw or something like this. When you see him do that crazy stuff, when you see his shredded six-pack in his body, his wild man appearance, you see the big ranch that he lives inside of, it hits you in a more fundamental and primal way. Like, our brains are obviously visual creations. Now, the great struggle of language, and this is such a fascinating thing to think about, is that it can't show us by definition. Language is based upon it explaining stuff to us. Language is a medium of telling. But the great artists of mankind have managed to overcome this limitation of language. They have managed to learn how to use language to create imaginary scenes inside of people's heads. So instead of language being used to explain stuff to you, I can use language in a certain way to paint pictures inside of your imagination. And this is the crux of the highest form of communication. This is how you storytell to an elite level. Say, for example, I want to communicate a story about a hero fighting a dragon. Now, if I sit down and just say, well, the hero was there and he ran up to the castle and then he fought the dragon and took the princess and everything was good, it doesn't really move you that much. But say I calm everything down and I say, the hero was sprinting. His shining hard armor was clinking as he came across the crest of a hill. A giant lightning bolt struck in the sky. The thunder was echoing through the horizon. The clouds were dark. And just as the hero came across the scene and could see the horizon, what stood in front of him was a tower towering, evil black, giant, monstrous castle, and around it was a screaming dragon with eyes bright red, wrapped around a tower as he could hear the echo of the princess's voice screaming in the darkness. The hero paused. He stood at the foot of this scene and his eyes went wide. The cold chill of adrenaline ripped down his spine and he took one step back, feeling that he could just turn away and run. But then his eyebrows furrowed. He clenched his teeth and he whipped out his sword and marched down to face his destiny. Now the story is the exact same, but the way it is told makes all the difference. In the second one, I am using my words to paint images and feelings and context inside of your mind, so you enter into the imaginative space that I see inside of my head, and I am doing the highest level of communication possible. I am transmuting what is inside my head. I am lifting it out and packaging it as language, sending it over to your brain and reconstructing a visualized experience inside of your head. Now think about what that is. Think about how amazing that is. I'm creating a movie inside of your mind. Think of the power that gives me. I am causing visualization experiences inside of your head using my words. I am sparking your imagination. I am filling your emotions with scenery. I am pulling big emotions out of you that you might never have felt before. Now, this is exactly what my writing mentors were trying to teach me to do. This is what exercises and procedures like the Flash were designed to do. Just like when you go into boxing and you punch a punching bag to try get your form correct, or you do pads to try get your form correct, these exercises are designed to do this, and they do this in a very simple way. They restrict the way that you use language. The Flash is a procedure that forces you to write about memories from your past, but you are not allowed to use declarative statements. You're not allowed to tell me the story. You have to instead use the restriction of sense-based language. That's all. That's the only trick to this, but it is an amazing difference that this makes. Now, I'll try to explain this as quickly and as simply as I can for the sake of time. The difference in how you would recite a memory, the wrong way and the right way, is based on how it would appear inside someone's imagination. So if you were going to tell me that you were a 4-year-old and you tripped up and hurt your toe and ended up in hospital, you could say that story to me. Oh, I remember I was 4 and I tripped up and I hurt my toe and I ended up in hospital. And you've given me this set of declarative facts and you are telling me a story. And maybe it could be interesting. You're like, oh, wow, because I know hospital is always dramatic. So I'd be like, wow, what was that? Hospital, that's crazy. Now, if you are to tell this story the way that I want you to do it, or the way that these writers and these mentors and this Flash exercise want you to do it, your task is to use your language in such a way that you paint the scene inside of my imagination. So you have to use language in a very specific way. Now, what is the way that you do that? If you explain to me, oh, I hurt my toe, it's not painting a picture inside of my head. That does not work. That is not what, that's just you being lazy and selfish and incompetent. Instead, what you need to understand is, how do you affect this computer inside of my brain? How do you create, how do you use words to create things inside of my head? And of course, that's by using sense-based language. That's the only trick you need. So instead of you sort of blathering on and telling me what happens, you would say something like, I was standing on the green grass, the sun was beating down on my face, I could feel the warm heat. I was blushing red. I remember my hands were covered in sweat. And right in front of me was this yellowish sand play pool. There was a kid inside of it with a digger and he was chugging stuff up. I could hear the crunching of this plastic shovel going inside of the sandbox. And I remember running over, probably felt that big rush of excitement that you do as a kid. I was probably screaming like a mad lad. And as I was running over, it was almost like my eyesight was bouncing as I was watching the hills across the horizon. And all of a sudden, it was just like, shoo, my eyesight just shot down and I saw everything really fast. And all of a sudden, my head was slammed into the sand. Now, lucky it was sand because my head was all right, but I really hurt my toe. I had just run over the wooden and rugged thing and my toe was sticking out the wrong way. And I remember rolling over and screaming and then seeing my mum run over. And she had that wide-eyed, grimaced look on her face of terror, of shock, of a concerned mother. Now again, you can see here that one of these is quite short and flat and lifeless. The one where I take the time to use sense-based language to describe to you all the little details, the sounds, the sights, the kinesthetic feelings, the blushing, the heat, the pain. I take the time to do all these things, to talk about what the senses experience, and it creates this imaginary space inside of your imagination. You can see the scene when you listen to me. That's what you need to learn. Now, I want you to understand this principle of showing and not telling, because it's a pretty monumental one. You can play around with this procedure and practice it yourself and develop this capacity inside of your head. Because I remember when I did this, it really took my capacity to imagine to a much higher level because it was so precise. It was broken down into a rubric, a simple procedure, a simple set of rules and principles that could allow me to train this in a very specific way. So I began in this floozy realm of the psychedelics, gone towards dreams, and I was naturally developing this capacity to imagine. Then I moved towards things like visualization and these types of skills, but now I was getting something that was logical, something that was binary, that was black and white. That if I want to develop my capacity to imagine, to develop imaginary scenes inside people's heads, I use this rubric, this schema, this framework of focusing on sense-based language, tantalizing people's senses. Now, what I loved about this is how broadly applicable this was. This became an incredibly useful asset if I wanted to do visualizations, because if I'm inside my own head, this is actually such a simple thing to think about if you want to visualize better. How do you visualize? What do you do? It's actually very, very simple. Sit down, get into your imagination, and try to think about things that are sense-based. So if you want to think about a scene, a big problem people have with visualization is they get very wrapped up with trying to explain to themselves. You know, I want to imagine a car. Don't try to say declarative statements like I want to imagine a car. Instead, sit down and imagine a wheel and think about the black rim of the wheel, and then think about the yellow paint, and then think about the window, and then think about the car moving, and think about the sound. Think about all that stuff. Thinking about sitting inside the seat and feeling the comfy leather on your hiney, squeezing your hiney in there. Think about grabbing the gear stick and going through the, I don't know, do people have gear sticks anymore? The Klaus Schwab has gotten rid of all our gear sticks. Is that what's coming next? And grabbing onto the steering wheel and driving it around. Imagine the feeling of the car pulling you back. Imagine the hum of the engine or the feeling of the vibration going on inside of yourself. And so when you're inside of it, it's so simple and it works. Sit down and just focus on tantalizing your own senses. And this has a double whammy effect. It gives you this incredible capacity to visualize. It's actually really entertaining and it's very, very practical. If you want to get better at boxing, you can do the same thing. Just put yourself in a situation and try to imagine, all right, the guy in front of you. Can you see his eyebrows? Can you see his hands? You know, what is happening with his hands? How do his hands move? Do you hear the sounds, the clapping of the feet? How do you feel? Can you feel? Can you bring back yourself to that heaving, heavy feeling of you being tired? Can you see his hand move? Can you see that little beginning of the motion, or maybe it's happening in the shoulder? And is that you reacting to it? Can you imagine what it's like for you to throw a punch? Because we often try to look at boxers maybe on the YouTube. You know, we watch the boxers on the YouTube, and the way we see punches is watching somebody else do them. And when we go and we try to fight, we obviously can't actually hit people, because us watching somebody else do something is not necessarily going to teach us exactly how to do it in the moment. If you want to counter the right hand, if someone's going to throw that big right hand, your experience of that when you're fighting is you're actually going to be seeing the knuckle come towards you. It's not something that you have this distance to. So you need to visualize yourself participating. It needs to be point of view, perspective, this type of thing. And so that will actually train you to get much, much better at it. And of course, you see the flash of the knuckle. You see the colors. You'll see his body come closer to you. You can imagine then yourself, what do your eyes do when you throw the counter right? It's not always like you're watching your opponent. Sometimes you have to, you know, kind of come around the right hand and things like this. And these details make a huge difference, because that's actually what you experience. But I remember I started to do this stuff and it was like I was fucking Neo in the Matrix or some bullshit. I remember going and doing sparring and things like this, and I was just so much better. Now, I'm no genius fighter or anything like this. I'm no Superman because of these things. I wish I spent more time in it. But it definitely did have a dramatic effect. It definitely lifted me up a level and made me much better than what what it would have been beforehand, with no expense to my brain, no me taking loads of heavy shots and getting my brain turned into scrambled eggs. Instead, I update the software without damaging the hardware. And something else amazing that comes out of this is that when you're in your life, when you're in reality, because you're spending your time trying to visualize certain experiences, you become an awful lot more sensitive to the sense-based reality around yourself. You'll actually notice that you'll listen to YouTube and you'll be listening to like some guy talk about politics or somebody talk about history or Rome or me talk about Nietzsche. And you'll walk around all day and you'll go through your life and you'll be lost in your left hemispheric abstractions, and you'll walk down this entire reality and not notice anything around you. And when I do visualization an awful lot, I'd start to notice things around me an awful lot more, and I start to engage with reality an awful lot more. I'd notice that stone, I'd notice that little weed, I'd see that wall, I'd see that person's face, I'd see their eyes, I'd see if they look disheveled or something like this. Or the next time I'm boxing and sparring, I'd actually notice things an awful lot better because I'm attuning myself to pay attention in my imagination, which actually allows me to learn more from reality and also allows me to engage with reality. And all of a sudden, that life that I'm living, I actually live it as opposed to being off lost in my head. Everything that I need is right there in front of me. I'm engaging with it in a detailed way. And it comes down to noticing these sense-based things. You step out of your house, or maybe in your house, and you notice the colors. You notice the distances, the shapes, the sounds. All of that stuff suddenly becomes magical again. And you can pay attention to it again. And it becomes new. And you start to observe all these things around you. And these are things that you are often separated from, living within the trapped gray reality that is created inside of your head by the school system to turn you into an NPC cuck that they can extract taxes out of so that you can be a slave towards debt-based usury. Oh, congratulations to you. This is how you start to break free from this and regain your anima and your soul and your spirit. And lastly, to bring this all together, this use of sense-based language and following these procedures that train you to do this and working even on things like visualization all eventually makes its way towards your ability to use language. You train yourself to use language, to storytell, to create mouth noises that send over packages of information that create imaginative experiences inside of other people's heads, and you become a better communicator. You become fantastic at articulating what you're seeing inside of your imagination, and that is so much more captivating compared to how most people speak. Most people are jargonites. Most people are absolutely terrible at communicating, and this is how you take yourself to another level. I often talk about this when I'm talking to people about storytelling. For example, Andrew Tate. Why do people, everybody hates him, yeah, whatever, but yeah, I gotta admit that the guy became famous for a reason, because he's very, very skilled. He's an amazingly competent communicator, and one of the traits that he's so good at is he's very good at storytelling, meaning he's very good at pausing when he's making a point and giving you this little analogy or this antidote or this story from his life. And he's very good at painting the picture about these stories. All of his stories about the time his dad got in a fight in a convenience store or something like this, these all stick inside of our imaginations because he paints the picture inside of our heads. He takes the time to do this. He's very, very good at storytelling, and he's worked on this. He actually understands that this is how you're supposed to storytell. He's spent his time over his life getting better and better at doing this. Or take somebody like Nietzsche. You look at Nietzsche. Nietzsche is fantastic at doing this as well. He's really good at bringing in sense-based language. In fact, he said this is one of the keys to being a good storyteller. He's brilliant at bringing you off into imaginary spaces. He's very, very good at narrating and creating these visions inside of your head. He's very good at using this tactile way of talking. Some of his wittiest and funniest statements all use this type of language. He would talk about when he's going among priests, he's going among people who like create ideals, delusional jargonites, perhaps we could call them. He talks about how he always has to put on his plastic doctor gloves because he's afraid of getting infected by all these sickly people. And it's little subtle things like this, this visual image of Nietzsche, the German incel, putting on this glove out of fear of touching these corpses, these weird bodies. This is this poetic instinct that he has inside of himself that's so powerful. He has this abundant creative imagination firing in all cylinders inside of his mind. And you'll find that this is a universal principle of good use of language, of good storytelling, of good communication. Your capacity to use visual analogies to spark the person's imagination that you're talking to. If you're trying to be a good teacher, you have to learn how to take the abstract concepts that you want to talk about and digest them down into simple, elegant language that you want to present. Individuation by Jung, or the Übermensch, or any of these high abstract concepts need to be chewed up and digested and presented in relevant imagery and relevant antidotes so that people can consume them, can chew them, can understand them, so you can spark people's imaginations and make it relevant to them. And that's your job as a high-level communicator. So many people in the world do not have time to get really deep into fucking Friedrich Nietzsche or something like this. And so it's our jobs as the experts to penetrate deeply into these topics and then try to render them for people as a whole so that as many people as possible in a diverse set of expert fields are able to integrate them all together. We need, you know, the medical doctors and the scientists to understand Nietzsche. We need the Nietzscheans to understand the medical doctors. We need to get medical geniuses who can break down the esoteric knowledge inside of medicine and present it and render it in a way that's accurate, but also analogous and easy to understand. That's the high level of cultural unity and cultural success. And storytelling and this type of visual speaking is relevant if you're going to be a sales guy, if you're going to be somebody who's trying to communicate to your friends, if you're going to be doing anything at all that involves communication, if you want to be a poet or an artist, this is going to have to be in all of it. This is going to have to be there for every single one of them, because that's how important it is for you to communicate to a high level. It's essential for your ability to articulate yourself. And the final thing I want to bring your attention to is how communicating with strong visual imagery, with strong sense-based language, makes your language more intense, makes the experience more intense. So for example, I've worked with people doing essentially psychology, being like a therapist, I guess you could say. And if they ever were struggling with what we might call a trauma, I would always try to get them to describe the trauma using sense-based language. Now what's very interesting is that they would often have a story, you know, a very simple story that they would describe this traumatic experience with. And if I asked them about it, they would just tell me the simple story. And this is how they've compartmentalized it inside of their mind so they don't have to feel it. But if I got them to tell the story but use this sense-based language, all of a sudden they have to go through all the feelings again. And it's a completely different experience. And what you notice is that it's like going through the experience without the condom on, you know? It's harder, it's more intense, you feel it on every single level. It sparks your nervous system, it's more emotional, it's more brutal for this reason. And so using language this way also makes language more potent, more powerful, more. It's got more zing to it, it's got more oomph, it's got more aggression. And that's a very important fact. Because you see this happen in the opposite style of communication, say for example humor. If you can tell a funny joke and establish or add in some sense-based imagery into it, it will always make the joke land better. It's so hilarious. We find it very funny when people pass off insults and fill their insults with very colourful descriptions. A great example of this is, again, Conor McGregor, who I think probably trained himself to develop this very visual way of thinking. And so he's in the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, and he's talking with a guy called Uriah Faber. And they're having a banter over and back. And Uriah says, you know, you're dressed weird today or something like this. You look like a leprechaun, you know. And Conor comes back just sharp as a nail. He comes back and he says, you look like a 50-year-old retired skateboarder. And this visual imagery of Faber looking like this specific dork, you know, it's such a brilliant conception. It's so harsh and so sharp. It's so brutal that Uriah has nothing he can say to it. You know, it's so incredibly original. It's so much better than calling him like a dickhead or a pussy or a loser. Instead, he paints this image of Uriah as a weird 50-year-old dork. And it's a knockout blow. It's just so visually powerful to do this. And it's hilarious as a consequence. And Conor was brilliant at this back when he was on his come up. It's almost like he was much better at it back then, where he was really, really good at generating these fast visual ideas very quickly. And you'll see this with most comedians, that they'll have this ability to deliver these ideas in these novel ways, and it will wrap around presenting them with these little analogies and these little sense-based language. And so you can see that this starts to saturate into everything you do. Once your visual imagination is switched on and you can get the applications right, it can transform all aspects of your life. And so I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Andrew Hubermensch podcast. You see that level? See all this creative imagination? I can do these types of fifth dimensional puns. The Andrew Huber Boyo podcast, the Hubermensch podcast has been done on how to transform your creative imagination, how to switch it on. Because you go through the schooling experience and it deadens you. It gets you trapped in the language categories of the left hemisphere. And you need to break out of that. And our experience about this is probably going to be an awful lot of hard drugs, but there's much more practical ways that you can do this. And you can actually develop a very interested, integrated approach. And throughout my life, I've gone through several of these. I started off in this grayscale reality. I took a load of psychedelics and it gave me a glimpse of what is possible. I then went and started to do dream reading. I then started getting into visualization. And finally, I started to find firm writing practices that really helped me develop this as well. And now I live in a way that I've got my creative imagination switched on, and it helps me in every area of my life, and it makes my life more enjoyable. It allows me to go out and just have fun. Me sitting in a room by myself, I can basically entertain myself for hours. It allows me to learn faster. It allows me to speak with more capacity and more power. And it gives me this ability to do pretty much anything intellectual that I want to do to a higher level than I would be able to do otherwise, because it's my brain that has been developed. I guess you could say, if this right hemisphere theory is correct, I've basically unlocked an entire other half of my brain, which is going to make me better overall. So I highly encourage all of you to work on this stuff. I highly, highly encourage you to develop these capacities. This framework and the schema I've laid out for you, you can go and practice all that stuff until your face turns blue. It will definitely bring you benefits. The trick here is to understand the general tool, which is this creative imagination, which is very vague and abstract, and understand that there's a lot of ways that you can switch this on. But the real magic is when you can understand how to turn on the general power and then bring it down and specify it in a particular avenue inside of your life. So for example, I switched on my creative imagination with dream reading, which is very, very abstract. And this would be like me building a load of muscle in the gym. It's, you know, I'm very strong. And it's like, that's great, Steph. You've got very high strength. But then I go into the boxing gym and I learn to use that strength in the context of a specific style of fighting like boxing. So I specify from the general thing. This is what you need to learn to do. And so with your creative imagination, it's the same thing. You want to develop that capacity to get that visual imagination switched on. And then you want to try take it and specify it into what you're doing. I, for example, use my visual imagination an awful lot when I'm doing these YouTube podcasts. I work very, very hard on trying to think, all right, what are some good analogies so I can paint pictures here? How can I really get people's imagination switched on? So when they listen to my YouTube podcast, they feel that they're having a really, really vivid experience, that they're having these dreams happening inside of their heads. And it's very stimulating and enjoyable for them. I'm giving them a fun and enjoyable and stimulating experience. I'm adding a bit more magic into their life. That's ultimately my goal with this stuff. And I use all these tools to help me do this stuff. And as I said, I go maybe and I do a little bit of boxing and I try and apply this stuff here as well. So the specifics is where you're going to make the magic power touch reality and really start to transform your life when it comes down to it. So thank you very much for your time. If you have any topics that you heard in this that you'd like me to talk about more, please tell me down in the comments. Please suggest what part of this you'd like me to dive deeper in, because there's so much in this that I can barely even scratch the surface on as it is right now. Now, perhaps you'd like to work on this stuff more intimately. You would like to go and dive in and have me help you with this professionally. Well, if you would like me to do that, you can go down below and book some one-on-one coaching, or you can join my group mastermind where we can all work on this stuff together, work on getting these specific applications set up so you can use your creative imagination, get it switched on and apply it to your life so that you can start to extract the juice out of reality and become the most powerful Ubermensch who has ever lived. So thank you for your time. Stay juicy and have a good one.